We are in 1 Samuel. Last week we finished chapter 18. That was where David got married to Michal. She is Saul's number two daughter. He was originally promised the number one daughter, but the number one daughter got married to somebody else. Saul is going into full-blown paranoia. As I mentioned last time, it says in chapter 8 that Michal loved David, and I mentioned that that's the only place in at least the Old Testament where a woman takes the initiative and loves a man. We have lots of people in love in the Old Testament, but you remember, for example, when Abraham sent his servant to get Rebekah as a wife for Isaac. The two of them had never laid eyes on each other. She shows up and it specifically says, he took her into his tent, she became his wife, and he loved her. That's sort of the biblical sequence. Marriages were arranged by families, and love is something that is learned as opposed to something that is the instigator of a marriage. So this is unusual. Just while I'm on the subject, the idea of getting married for romantic love is fairly recent. I would imagine probably 19th century. Before that, marriages were arranged for a variety of reasons, sometimes for political reasons, sometimes for business reasons between families, sometimes just two families knew each other and they knew the two young people and decided this would be a good match. But the idea of going out to a bar somewhere and falling in love and then getting married is a relatively recent phenomenon. So anyway, Saul tries to get David killed. Remember, the bride price he was asking for was 100 Philistine foreskins. And the idea there in Saul's mind is I'll send this eager young buck out there on an impossible mission and he'll get killed and I'll be rid of it. David says, woo, and brings back 200. So tonight, we're going to go into serious paranoia on Saul's part. And one of the things that we'll see as we go through this is Saul is the only one who's paranoid. He marries Michal to David with the idea that she's going to be a spy in his family. Similarly, he tries to get Jonathan on his side with the idea that if you don't get on my side and we don't get rid of this guy David, you're not going to be king after me. So the whole thing is based on paranoia, and both Michal and Jonathan side with David. So none of his plots come to fruition, and we're going to spend the next several chapters with David on the run from Saul. Remember we said last time, or I said last time, that the David and Goliath story felt like it was out of sequence because David had been in Saul's court as a singer and his armor bearer in the chapter before Goliath. And then when he goes and he slays Goliath, Saul says, who is that guy? So it feels to me like it was written out of sequence, which is fine. I don't have any problem with that. I'm just noting it. We got the same thing going to happen tonight, because what we're going to have feels like one vignette repeated. So we're going to have a case where Saul is going to wing a spear at him, try and pin him to the wall, and then David is going to come back. And then later on, Saul's going to try it again. So it sort of feels like we may have a repeat of the same thing. I mean, it's not important, but it's sort of an indicator of how this was put together. So now we're on chapter 19. And Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David, and Jonathan told David, Saul, my father seeks to kill you. Therefore be on your guard in the morning, stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak to my father about you. If I learn anything, I will tell you. So the king has given instructions to everybody in his court, take this kid out. Jonathan is defying his father. And both Jonathan and Michal will defy him. And Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds have brought good to you. For he took his life in his hand and struck down the Philistine. And the Lord worked a great salvation for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause?" And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan reported to him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. So I don't know whether Saul is being deceitful or Saul is mentally unstable. Yes, he is mentally unstable because he says, "As the Lord lives, this won't happen," which sort of indicates that at least at the moment he is sincere. Now, when his mental processes go sideways, he is, of course, going to forget that oath and try to kill David. Verse 8, "And there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a great blow, so that they fled before him. Then a harmful spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with a spear in his hand. And David was playing the lyre. And Saul sought to pin David to the wall with a spear, but he eluded Saul, so that he struck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night." So there's incident number one. And of course, this is going to happen again. And the thing that I find a bit strange, David is not stupid, obviously, is that he would go back and give Saul another crack at him with a spear. So that's why I'm sort of the opinion that the second incident with a spear may be a repetition. As I say, do with that as you please, just my opinion. So verse 11, "Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him, that he might kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, 'If you do not escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed.' So Michal said, 'Let David down through the window,' and fled away and escaped. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair at its head and covered it with the clothes." So she's obviously stuffed his bed so that anybody looking will think he's still there, not realize he's fled, and obviously give him a head start as he's fleeing. Verse 14, "And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, 'He's sick.' Then Saul sent the messenger to see David, saying, 'Bring him up to me in the bed that I may kill him.'" So the fact that he is sick is no barrier to Saul. "Pick him up, bed and all, and bring him here and we'll kill him." 16, "And then the messengers came, and behold, the image was in the bed with the pillow of goat's hair at its head. Saul said to Michal, 'Why have you deceived me thus and let my enemy go so that he has escaped?' And Michal answered Saul, 'He said to me, let me go. Why should I kill you?'" All right, now what Michal is doing is saying, David said, "Your dad is after me. If you don't let me go and cover for me, I'll kill you." So she's saying, "The only reason I did that, Dad, is because I was in fear of my life." She is obviously, according to the part of the story that Saul is not privy to, saving her husband, whom she loves. But she also doesn't want to anger her father, hence the excuse, "He threatened to kill me if I didn't do what he said." One of the things that occurred to me as I was reading this, we had a discussion in here, years ago, and I don't remember what the catalyst of the discussion was, but the whole idea is, if you believe in God, you can't lie. You shouldn't lie. Lying's always wrong. We had a long discussion about it, and what we discover is David, for example, is lying by deception, where he stuffs the bed and lets people think that he's actually still there. That's a falsehood. You have, of course, Rahab the harlot that lies on behalf of the Israelite spies. Jonathan is going to lie to his father. There's all sorts of people in the Bible that are otherwise heroic that lie. And what we finally came down to was lying in the preservation of life is perfectly acceptable. So McCall is trying to save her husband, whom she loves, and I don't know whether she realizes how unbalanced her father is, because one of the things going to happen is Jonathan is going to help David escape, and Saul is going to cuss him out in front of the whole court. And that is an unstable act. So I don't know whether McCall just doesn't want to offend her father or is afraid that he may go ballistic and do something to her. Just don't know the answer to that, obviously. So verse 18. Now David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and lived in Naioth. Now, Naioth and Ramah are both in the same district. They are both on the central ridge route going north and south. So they are north of where Saul and his court are, and that's where Samuel hangs out because that was his home, obviously. And he's pretty much stayed there ever since the Lord had rejected Saul from being king. So David flees up to Samuel, and it's just north of where the palace is. Verse 19. And it was told Saul, behold, David is at Naioth in Ramah. Then Saul sent messengers to take David, and when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing his head over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. And Saul sent messengers again a third time, and they also prophesied. So what's obviously happening here is he's sending trusted lieutenants. And what this very much reminds me of is the incident with Elijah when he's up sitting on a hill and the king sends a squad of 50 soldiers and said, go bring that guy to me. And fire falls down from heaven and consumes him. Does that a second time. Fire falls down from heaven and consumes him. Does that a third time. And the commander of the 50 in this case goes up to Elijah on his hands and knees and says, please, would you come talk to the king and don't toast me, I'm just the messenger. So at that point, he goes down and talks to the king. But this incident here with sending three sets of messengers to pick up David reminds me very much of that incident. And in both cases, what you have is a prophet involved. So Samuel, of course, is a prophet, as was Elisha. Now, I don't know if Samuel is the one that is instigating the spirit falling on these messengers or whether God is doing it, but the point is David is being supernaturally protected. Verse 22. Then he himself, Saul, went to Ramah and came to the great well that was in Sichem, and he asked, where are Samuel and David? And one said, behold, they are in Naioth and Ramah. And he went there to Naioth and Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also. And as he went, he prophesied until he came to Naioth at Ramah. And he too stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay naked all that day and all that night. Thus it was said, is Saul also among the prophets? And you remember, this is the second time this has happened with Saul. When he was anointed by Samuel the first time, and he met a group of prophets, and he started prophesying among them. And quite frankly, I don't know what it looks like biblically when somebody prophesies. But I can imagine, because there are religious sects that sing and dance and all that kind of stuff when they are prophesying or they believe the Spirit is upon them. So I can see that it's sort of like talking in tongues except physical. Don't know what you're doing and you're twirling and singing and dancing and all those kinds of things. But the point is, it is obvious to everybody what's going on. So this is not some kind of a quiet inward call of the Holy Spirit that only you know about. This is obvious to everybody. The question was, why did he strip off all of his clothes? I don't know. It sort of feels very much like somebody running down a beach and stripping and going skinny dipping into the ocean. The comment was, if people saw this happening, they're going to say this guy's crazy. The Bible says he's prophesying. And what I will direct you to is Acts, where you've got the fire falling and the Spirit falling on the people in the upper room, and all of the people out there say, these guys are drunk. And Peter says, no, they're not drunk. It's only 9 o'clock in the morning. The other thing I am surmising, I do not know what prophesying looks like in this context. But you remember when Moses called the 70 elders up, and we had Nadab and Abihu, who were in the camp, and everybody says, they started to prophesy. So obviously something that people in that culture recognize. When Saul is first anointed and he goes down the mountain and he meets a group of prophets and he starts to prophesy among them, people say exactly the same thing. Is Saul also among the prophets? So I don't know what it looks like, but I'm sort of imagining singing and dancing and probably quite a frenzy. But why he goes starkers in that process, I do not know. Comment was, this also feels somewhat like David when he brought the ark into Jerusalem. The only thing I would quibble with is, translation I have is that he's wearing a linen ephod. The way I would describe it is, it would be like a woman dancing in her slip. In other words, he's covered, but a woman just wouldn't go out. Maybe they would now, but 50 years ago, a woman would not have gone out and danced down the street in her slip. So I sort of regard it that way. But if your translation says naked, I'll have to look at the Hebrew and see what it says. But anyway, short answer is David is being supernaturally protected, and everybody who comes at him in this particular vignette winds up being smacked by the Spirit and prophesying, whatever that means. Very much in the New Testament, when the Spirit falls on people, everybody around knows it. So you also have Peter and Cornelius, where Peter is talking to Cornelius and his household. The Spirit falls on the Romans, and the Jews all know it. It's not some quiet inner conversion that makes you feel all good and warm inside. There's something obvious to everybody that has happened. And that's obviously what's going on here. Chapter 20. So now we're going to have this elaborate charade. So David fled from Naioth in Ramah and came and said before Jonathan. So he goes back to Jonathan. What have I done? Where is my guilt? What of my sin before your father that he seeks my life? And he said to him, far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing great or small without disclosing it to me. Why should my father hide this from me? It is not so. That particular conversation is Jonathan is remembering what his dad said the first time. Jonathan said, what are you doing? And Saul says, as the Lord lives, David shall not die. So Jonathan is still operating on that conversation. And he says, as far as I know, Dad hasn't changed his mind. He lets me in on everything he does. So we're still operating in the last conversation as far as Jonathan is concerned. Verse 3, but David vowed again, saying, your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes. And he thinks, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death. David is saying to Jonathan, yeah, I heard what you said, but your dad knows that you like me, so he is not letting you in on his plans in this matter. And furthermore, I'm one step ahead of a spear. Then Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do. David said to Jonathan, behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit at table with the king, but let me go, that I may hide myself in the field till the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the clan. If he says, good, it will be well with your servant. But if he is angry, then know that harm is determined by him. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. In other words, you and I are in covenant not to harm each other. So please go check this out for me. We're at 8.5. But if there is guilt in me, kill me yourself. For why should you bring me to your father? And Jonathan said, far be it from you. If I knew that it was determined by my father that harm should come to you, would I not tell you? Then David said to Jonathan, who will tell me if your father answers you roughly? And Jonathan said to David, come, let us go into the field. So they both went into the field. The question here is, Jonathan says, okay, I'll do it. Well, you know, you'll be absent from the feast. And if my dad gets grumpy with me at your excuse, I'll tell you. David says, how are you going to tell me? Because this is parenthetical, not scripture. Your dad knows you love me, and I suspect that he's going to have you tailed. So how are you going to get the word to me one way or the other, assuming that he means me harm? And I would suggest that probably the unspoken thing here is your dad is going to tail you to make sure that you don't send me a message. 12. And Jonathan said to David, the Lord God of Israel be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if he is well disposed toward you, shall I not stand and disclose it to you? In other words, if the answer is positive, I'll just come to you. There's no problem. It's only if the answer is negative that we're going to have a problem here. And so now what we're going to do is set up this deal where he's going to take a young boy and bow and arrows, and he's going to shoot some arrows, and they got a code word between them. If the kid just picks up the arrows, everything's fine. But if I tell the kid, I've shot it beyond you, go farther, then you know that things are not fine. I'm not going to read all that, but basically that's the code. Verse 24. So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat to eat food. The king sat on his seat, as at other times, on the seat by the wall. Jonathan sat opposite, and Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Yet Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought something has happened to him. He's not clean. So he's done something that has made him unclean, and he can't be here because he's got to wait till evening and wash it, and so forth. 27. But on the second day, the day after the new moon, David's place was empty, and Saul said to Jonathan his son, why is not the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today? Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He said, let me go, for our clan holds a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. So now, if I have found favor in your eyes, let me go away and see my brothers. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table. So we've given the excuse. And Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. And he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, did I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? This, by the way, is Bible speak for saying, you son of a whore. And what he's doing, by the way, is this is in the presence of his entire court. He doesn't take his son off to one side in private and chew him out. He does it in front of everybody. So again, he's unhinged. 31. This is still Saul speaking. For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. So Saul knows that the kingdom is taken from him. And if David lives, Jonathan is not going to sit on the throne. Then Jonathan answered Saul, his father, why should he be put to death? What has he done? But Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. So he pitches his spear at his own son. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. And Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. When it says he threw his spear to strike him, it doesn't say that he skittered out of the way like David does. I am sort of thinking that he grabs his spear in a rage and he's not really trying to hit his son. He is simply throwing the spear against the wall because he's so angry and frustrated. That's a guess. He isn't trying to kill his son. He's simply angry and frustrated and wants to break things. So that's sort of what he's doing. 35. In the morning, Jonathan went out to the field to the appointment with David, and with him a little boy. And he said to his boy, "Run and find the arrows that I shoot." As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the boy came to the place of the arrow that Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the boy and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?" So there's your code word. And Jonathan called after the boy, "Hurry, be quick, do not stay." So Jonathan's boy gathered up the arrows and came to his master, but the boy knew nothing. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter. And Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said to him, "Go and carry them into the city." In other words, "I'm done with target practice. Take my stuff back." And as soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times, and they kissed one another and wept on one another, David weeping the most. Then Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, because we have sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever.'" And he rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. Now, the other thing I don't understand here is why we went through the charade with the arrows. Well, maybe I do. It may be the case that he took the boy and the bow and the arrows so he wouldn't be followed. "We're going to go out in the field and do some target practice, and whoever has been set to bird dog him or his father, don't think that he's going to meet David." So that may be what's going on here. But once the kid's sent away and they both walk up, you sort of wonder, well, why didn't you just go to the field and walk up to the stone heap and talk to him straight away? But it may have been part of the ruse to not have anybody following. That's the only thing I can think of. The comment was that one of the things that's going on is, in some cases, following the Lord is going to result in family separation. And that's happening here, where you've got Saul's two children abandon him and go with David. So, yeah, I would agree. Their question was, what is it about David that has caused Michal and Jonathan to choose him over their own father? And in both cases, to their detriment, because Jonathan will wind up losing the kingdom, and Michal will wind up not being the daughter of the king, even though she will eventually be married to the king. Interesting character analysis, if you will, by this guy from Hillsdale that we watched talking about this. You remember when Saul was chosen, what we said is the guy that you would go to central casting, "I need a hero." Saul would be the guy you'd pick. Tall, good-looking, humble, strong, brave in battle, all those things, all the characteristics that you could want. David is the same way. David is tall, good-looking, personable. He can also sing, and he can also dance. He's charismatic. He is able to lead troops in battle successfully. So the idea there is that people like him. Doesn't hurt also that he's now the Lord's anointed. That is bothering Saul, but it doesn't bother either Michal or Jonathan. I think it's an indicator, if you will, of David's charisma, is I guess the best way to describe it. People like him. People want to follow him. He's not only charismatic, but he's competent. He's got a reputation as a successful commander. In fact, there's a general in World War II who took over command of a division, I think, in the Pacific. and they had been banged up and so forth. He went in there and took command, and of course nobody knew him or anything like that, and these guys had been banged up. And he set up his radio call sign as Lucky Six. And his reasoning was, they don't know me, but I want them to think that I'm lucky. And I think it was Matthew Ridgway who went on to be very, very, very successful. But this idea of deliberately choosing a call sign that would give his troops confidence, David is the same kind of a guy. He's charismatic and he's successful and he's competent and people like him. Chapter 21. Then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest. And Ahimelech came to meet David trembling and said to him, why are you alone and no one with you? So David obviously is a commander of troops, and for him to be wandering around all by himself is unusual. And David said to Ahimelech the priest, the king has charged me with a matter and said to me, let no one know anything of the matter about which I set you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place. So again, David is lying, okay? Next time somebody gets all self-righteous about you can't believe in God and tell lies, take them to 1 Samuel 21. Yeah, you can. So anyway, he says, I've got a secret mission, and I've got some guys I'm going to meet in a few minutes at another place. Verse 3. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever is here. And the priest answered David, I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread. If the young men have kept themselves from women, and David answered the priest, truly, women have been kept from us always when I go on an expedition. So the idea then is, all right, I got showbread, and if your guys have not been fooling around with their wives or anybody else, we can let them have it. And David says, when we go on an expedition, we start off chaste. And quite frankly, I can see that being the case. Because you remember at Mount Sinai, when they were going to get the Ten Commandments, God's instruction was, make sure husbands and wives do not come together for 3 days beforehand. So the idea of troops going on a special mission would not surprise me at all if they took a mikvah and spent 3 days away from home to get themselves spiritually ready to go. So that wouldn't surprise me a bit. So verse 5 again. And David answered the priest, truly women have been kept from us as always when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy, even when I was on an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy? Routinely, we consecrate ourselves before we go into a battle. How much more for this special mission? Verse 6. So the priest gave him the holy bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day it is taken away. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg. He was the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. Now, detained before the Lord, according to commentary I read, indicates that he wasn't able to go into the tabernacle. He was unclean for some reason. That's what's being talked about there. I have no better information than that, by the way. So anyway, this guy sees David and sees what's going on. Verse 8. Then David said to Ahimelech, then have you not here a spear or a sword at hand? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. And the priest said, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you struck down in the valley of Elah. Behold, it is here wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is none but that here. And David said, there is none like that, give it to me. So this whole conversation sort of requires willing disbelief on the part of the priest. The other part of that, of course, is David is well known. And I don't know that the priest is aware that the king is out to get him. But it would really be odd for the king's armor bearer to have to go beg food and beg for a weapon. And they say he obviously gets everything, and it's either an indicator of his high status that nobody questions him, or willing disbelief on the part of the priest. Verse 10. And David rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish said to him, "Is not this David, the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s." So he flees to the Philistines, and the Philistine says, "Whoa, wait a minute, we're not sure we want you around." And David took these words to heart and was much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands and made marks on the doors of the gate and let his spittle run down his beard. I don't know what the marks on the doors of the gate are. Perhaps scratching and clawing at the gate, I'm guessing. That might be the marks we're talking about. And then, of course, foaming at the mouth. Verse 14. Then Achish said to his servants, "Behold, you see the man is mad. Why then have you brought him to me? Do I lack for madmen that you have brought this fellow to behave as a madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" So he realizes that he has made a mistake fleeing to Gath and tries to redeem the situation, successfully in this case, by pretending that he's crazy. He's lying again. So anyway, we'll stop there. We'll pick it up at 22 next time, where David continues to flee from Saul. Saul is going to go back and forth. Sometimes he'll say, "You're more righteous than I." Sometimes he'll try and kill him. But I think that's the case of Saul's paranoia rising and falling, if you will.